Tonight I'd like to speak about the anatomy of love. Not exactly that object-centered love. I love you, I love chocolate, I love green leaves, all of that. It's true, we love many things on this earth. But what's really the nature of love? And the nature of our heart. When we turn to our experience, one thing that we can notice is that the heart is where everything is made personal. Experience is made personal. All experience. Not just what we associate with personal, relationships, history, but all experience. And what we understand in practice, we have to make it personal. It cannot be general truths, universal truths, even if they are. We have to make them our own. And that happens in the heart. It's also true that the most central and difficult issues in our life, they're centered right in the middle of the heart. That's why we get the aches and we become tender. I'd like to share a little story with you. About 8 months ago, I was piling up wood in a wood pile together with my family. And in a moment of mistaken identity, of thinking I was Superwoman, I was catching pieces of wood as they came flying into a pile, and then I would put them in a nicer pile in the woodshed. And there were smaller pieces coming my way, and then there was a big one, and on impulse I just stretched out my hand and caught it, and the hand said and it hurt. So I continued piling wood with the left hand, and I thought the idea appeared in my mind, I probably tore a muscle, maybe a ligament. Sometime later, I realized that I don't really know how ligaments function. I don't know much about the anatomy of a hand, actually. These were just ideas in my mind. Just like, okay, this explains it then. Something hurt, it explains it. So it was swollen for some time, 6 months to be exact. And then finally one day I thought, okay, maybe I should actually check this out. But it's amazing what you can get used to, how much you can use a hand, even if you can't. So with this one, you can kind of turn it and flex it. This one, not so much. But you can get used to it. So I spent too much time in hospital as a child. So it's still my pattern. If I can avoid going to hospitals, I do. So it took me 6 months, and I went to the hospital, I did the x-rays, and blah, blah, blah. And then one morning I came to the hospital, and there was the doctor, and I came into his office, and he was completely present, and he took my hand in the most gentle but steady way, checked it, looked at his papers. But his presence was so full that I got more interested in what kind of practice he did in his life and then hearing about my hand. And had I not liked my partner so very much, I would have fallen in love with him completely. So he told me, well, you have a broken bone in your hand. And why did you wait 6 months? And I had some explanations to this, but okay, so there we were. And then he said to me, okay, so, it's a small bone, but it's in the wrist. therefore have to take a little bit of bone from your hip, put a few screws, then you have a plaster for 4 months, then some rehabilitation going to be fine. My first response was friendly on the surface, but my heart just went sealed off like Teflon. And I thought, no. Too many retreats. Children, who's going to care for the house? I cannot have plaster for 4 months. Not possible. That's not possible. And I have a left hand, right? That should be enough. But he was so nice, and he continued to talk to me. And so some years of practice has a little bit of effect. So the Teflon state didn't last for too long. And then I started to feel, well, okay, this is how it is. And then I started to get a little bit enthusiastic, and I thought, 4 months, I cancel all. Can't use the right hand. Somebody has to cook. Somebody has to clean. I could get a lot of support. This could be wonderful. Look at this. Somebody else can pile the wood. Fantastic. It will be a wonderful retreat. And the hand will be there, and I could get a lot of good physical treatment, so the healing speeds up. Oh yeah, I could get massage. That's really nice. And I got all enthusiastic. Then he said, so we're going to do this. Do you want to go and see the anesthesiologist? And that's what you call it, right? The person that puts you to sleep. To just plan things. And I came to this person, and first I had to wait in a little room. And the worst experience of my childhood was when I had a problem with one of my kidneys, and I had to do operations, was when they put, in those days, the mask over the face. I thought I would die and that they were killing me. And so I worked with this for many years. But this person, this anesthesiologist, she came just from the operation theater. She had her mask on, she stepped in the door and she pulled it up. And something just hit my heart, like, oh. And a sign of my own maturity was actually that I said to her, hey, there's something about you that makes me scared, because I had this experience in childhood. Could we just be together a little bit here? And then big warm tears started to roll down my face, and I felt completely fine with that. And I thought, how interesting. I'm sitting crying with a stranger. And so this would normally be completely contrary to my character. And she was very friendly and very warm. And by this time I thought, this hospital is great. I'll stay the whole day here. And she took my hand and she started to talk to me as if I was about 5 and a half. And she said, well, first we're going to do like this. And, you know, in the 70s it was very different. And these days we knock you out in this way and that way. And we do like this. And, you know, I can sit and hold your hand. And she was wonderful. And I kind of sailed out from there and thought, okay, This is going to be a very good experience. And now I can also work on this aspect. If there is some remains of this trauma in my body, then, you know, I could get some good body work for that also. And then a couple of weeks later, I did some more x-rays to check exactly where the screws were going to be put in. And then one morning, the nice doctor called and he said, I don't get this. I don't know what's happened, but the bones have started to heal. And I don't think you should have an operation. It's probably going to be okay anyway. And I can check in with you in September sometime. I was a little bit disappointed. You know, I had a good thing going here with this hospital. Compassion, which is one of the fundamental capacities of the heart, not the false copy with this pity, you know, when we feel sorry for somebody, but real compassion, doesn't do so much, but it is willing to turn towards the difficult. It just turns towards the difficult. Actually, we cannot have objective understanding about our own experience or somebody else's experience without compassion. It's what's needed to accept one's hurts and one's wounds without defense, without resentment. It's intimately related to dukkha, suffering, that which is hard to bear. It's a kind of openness that says your suffering, my suffering, is totally connected. It says, yeah, let it come, let it open, let it be. Another fundamental quality of the heart is that of loving kindness that we started to touch on this afternoon. It's that kind of friendliness, the friendliness of the heart, a quality of welcome. This is here. You can be here too. Welcome. Have a seat. Spread out. It's a kind of warm acceptance, not like that, you know, these kind of commercials. It's like, get the extra glossy, super fantastic hair product because you're worth it. You know, not like that. It just provides a place, a friendly place that's inclusive. Actually, true awareness is by default kind. True, uncolored, genuine awareness is kind in its nature. In a way, awareness and kindness cannot really be separated. In fact, awareness is the foundation for kindness because it means to come in contact. And kindness is the natural expression of awareness. Sometimes we may feel kind of mentally aware, but it's a very narrow bandwidth. True awareness is inclusive. There's a poem by Rumi you may have heard. This being human, a guest house, every morning a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all, even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your hives empty of its furniture. Still, treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door, smiling, and invite them in. Be grateful for whatever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. One of the most important teachings for me about kindness was when I was 17, and I was traveling in India, and I was deep in the countryside of Tamil Nadu in South India. And I was going to a particular village that had no real proper road access. So I jumped off the bus, and then I walked, and I kind of knew where I should walk. And I got a ride with somebody on a bicycle on the back, and then I got a ride on a bullock cart in the back of that one, and then I walked. And then I came across a little hut, dirt poor, with mud walls and leaf roof, rice fields around, and there was nothing. It was just brown earth around, and one tree, a papaya tree. And as it is in South India, the woman was sifting grains from their covers outside, a bit like we did in Europe in medieval times. And the family saw me, and said, come, come, invited me in. And then the father said to the oldest son, you up tree. And the son climbed up the tree and cut down the papaya. And I felt like, no, 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 no. The one big fruit, the only fruit in this tree, don't cut it. They went down, cut it, sliced it open, served it. Just like that. No hesitation. It impacted my whole being so completely that I can't help myself when I have friends or guests at home. I have to cook. I have to do something. My children's friends, they know. Sometimes it feels like I have a little river through my house, and this river sort of on top of it goes ice cream, fruits, cookies, and it just sort of... But there is something about generosity and the kindness and the feeling of giving. When we can be generous, it actually makes us feel robust. It builds us. It builds our heart. I have heard, I don't know if it's true, that a proper Bedouin host, when somebody passes by, probably it doesn't happen so often, somebody passes by, you take care of the camels, give the camels water, invite the guest in, serve mint tea, and you can ask the name of the person. But then you have to wait for 3 days and 3 nights before you say, so what are you doing out here in the desert? And what do you have in your luggage? And where do you come from? You wait for 3 days and 3 nights just to give space, just to make sure they're rested. What would it be like to treat ourselves with authentic kindness, real kindness? That kind of gentle receptivity of the heart that just helps us pace ourselves, to metabolize things, to align with our own digestion of experience, to integrate, to be with. So sometimes we can actually access our heart by remembering kindness, inclining the heart, inclining the mind, our attention to kindness, to compassion. We can. But there are other access points as well. Another one, and a good one, is actually anger. When we feel angry and defended, that kind of rigidity. Do you know what an exoskeleton is? It's what bugs have, like insects. You kind of have your stuff on the outside. So instead of skeleton inside, it's on the outside. It's that kind of false strength when we feel rigid, inflexible. It's a kind of armor. And sometimes we access our heart by turning towards the armor when we feel like a tank. You know, I'm strong and I can do this. Or when we feel like we have to defend and protect ourselves, we can actually turn to the armor and bow down to it. To really bow to it and trust it's been there for a historic reason. And behind there somewhere is the true heart. We don't need to crack open the armor. We can meet it. You know, a strong heart, because the heart also has strength, a strong heart is fierce but sensitive at the same time. It goes well together. Fierceness or strength and deep, 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 deep sensitivity. And when we can access the spectrum, we feel confident. We have a kind of confidence in our own heart. You know, to really live life, we really need a beating heart. We really need to have a heart that's alive, that wants to live. We need to have access to our wanting to live. It's important. It's important for awakening. Rumi says, "For years I copied other people. I tried to know myself. From within I could not decide what to do. Then I heard my name called. I stepped outside." When we step outside our exoskeleton, the ego structure, when we open up the field of awareness, sometimes it can be almost like a calling, like we just feel, oh, this is a possibility to expand here. And so the heart, when the heart can be sensitive and strong, we can have the courage to live our life. And the kind of attitude in practice that says, I can be with this. I can be with it. Or the attitude in practice that says, show me what I need to see. Show me what I need to see. What is going on here? What do I need to be with? One of the most challenging things that also happens, is mainly located and affecting the heart, is the shame and the guilt and the self-hate, the self-loathing, all that stuff that is kept hidden and covered in the heart, that is rarely spoken about, and that can be so compulsive. A couple of years ago, I was driving, and I passed one of these routine police controls, and I just sort of spotted it almost when I was driving by it. And through my mind went this high-speed checklist that was completely ridiculous. First I thought, drinking, have I been drinking? It was Tuesday morning or something, and if there was one thing that was sure, it was I had not been drinking and driving. I mean, that's impossible. It went through my mind. Then it's like, winter tires. No winter tires on. That's okay. Okay, am I driving too fast? It was a traffic jam. I wasn't driving too fast. And I just, do I have my driving license? I just went through it. And when I drove by, I wasn't stopped. I felt embarrassed, as if I'd done something wrong. There were some people there checking people in cars, and I felt ashamed. But why? I wasn't driving too fast. I had summer tires on and it was summer. I had my driving license. It was so instantaneous. And I kind of looked at myself while I was continuing and I thought, it's crazy. It's crazy how quick the shame comes. I had a little swim before I came in here, and in my room there's a mirror, small and long mirror, and when I came up from the bath, I just caught a view of myself, and with the sunlight shining in on the mirror, and I just saw myself objectively with all the things sort of being affected by gravity and the cellulites and the rest of it. And I saw myself kindly, objectively, but kindly. I liked myself, as it is. Kindness meeting up the forces of judgment. So important, because it's so exhausting to attack oneself. It's completely exhausting. And the response of kindness, of love, is more fundamental and more true than self-hate, than judgment. It's a strong defensive reaction. It's one of the hindrances turned towards oneself, the anger, the aversion. Now, what do you normally feel guilty about? Do you have a top 10 list? Feel ashamed over? You know, going to the body is always a good thing. So what things you judge about your body, or the way you are in relationship, let's say intimate relationships with a partner, with a lover, or with your children, or with your parents, or at work. The top tune of self-judgment is that we're never good enough, right? There is a gap between who we are and who we think we should be, and we keep staring at that gap and saying, it's not okay, it's not okay, it's not okay. Why is it that we cannot live with being, first of all, a work in progress? No, we're all works in progress. This path of awakening, it's not like there is an end destination and it's all okay. You know, we're a work in progress. It's an awakening process. And why is it so hard for us to be with incompleteness? You know, there is perfection, but things are rarely perfect. There's always something that's a little bit off, you know, even when you try to make something perfect. It's not how things really work. Zen Master Dogen, he says, to be in harmony with everything's unity is to be in harmony with everything's incompleteness. So we have this gap, who I am and who I should be. It's hard for everyone, self-judgment. I never met a single person that did not have to work with self-judgment in some way or form. Then when you become a spiritual practitioner, so you don't only have the normal standards to live up to, so you have the paramis and the perfections of the awakened mind, yes, very good, Buddha nature, very good. There the inner critic has something to chew on, right? That's a lot. How does it make you feel, the critic attack? What's the effect? Crippling, shutting down, destroyed, shattered. What's it like? Sometimes for some people when it goes on too often, too long, all the time, it's absolutely destroying. It destroys one's being. It's too much. It just is too much. We have this saying in Swedish, troll spricker i solen. Trolls, they kind of go poof in sunlight. Becoming aware of and seeing clearly with the light of awareness these little demons in the mind, aversion, as self-hate, as self-judgment, when light of awareness shines on them again and again and again, they go poof. They cannot sustain themselves. You know, when we're self-judgmental, it makes us act in funny ways. We start to compensate for the deficiency we feel. We work hard. We strive. We try hard because somehow we feel deficient. You recognize that? Or we adapt and please because something is inherently wrong with us, so we have to be extra nice and extra kind and say yes and do good things in life because something is not quite right on the inside. Or we start to avoid, we just shut down. Some of us develop an exoskeleton, we're hard on the outside, and others become a bit more like some little creature that crawls into a hole in the ground and just stays away, just pulls out of life, just exits. Depression is a good thing because depression puts a kind of like a lid on all sort of feelings. So can be better to feel low than to feel the sharp pain of self-judgment. And then we feel ashamed about the fact that we feel shame. And we judge ourselves for the fact that we're self-judgmental. We recognize that kind of goes round and round and round. But we can see this without going into the story about how bad, ugly, hopeless we are. We can see it and recognize it. Judgment. It's a force of anger and defendedness in the mind. Twisted, yes, but it can be recognized and seen. And in this I have absolute confidence. I have met and seen and worked and been with so many people that have transformed these patterns. Even when the judge inside happens to be a killer, sometimes it's like that. So can we relax a bit? Is it possible to relax and allow ourselves to be works in progress? Good enough practitioners. Good enough human beings. Like Mark Twain said, good judgment comes from experience. Experience comes from bad judgment. Can we try? Can we be allowed to live a bit? Try, stumble, fall, and then do it better. Another favorite saying I have on my notice board at home comes from Robert K. Hall, American poet of the 70s, hippie poet and Dharma teacher. And he had a book of poetry that was what's called Flapping Your Wings Can Also Be Flying. I think actually most things I do is a kind of flapping of the wings. Sometimes you take off and you think, oh, look, I'm flying. Who would have thought? And other times it's just a kind of, you know. Okay, but there is an important question here. What about the things that we should really feel ashamed of? You know, the stuff we've done, the stuff that was not okay. How should we relate to that? It's true, most of the shame and the guilt is self-caused, and it's not true. It's simply not true. It's not right to our tender hearts. It's cruelty towards ourselves. But what about the things where we did something wrong? How should we relate to that? You know, objective, compassionate regret, when we're truly sorry, it opens up our practice. It brings more awareness. It opens something up for us when we can feel, that was wrong, I'm sorry. It actually supports us to change behaviors and actions. But this kind of habitual, automatic beating of oneself is not transformative, does not bring more awareness, does not open up practice. Is there something in your life that's unforgivable? What would happen if you forgave yourself? What would happen if you could accept and meet that also with kindness, with compassion? Sometimes, there have been times when we've been really bad parents. You know, it happens for everyone. Sometimes we've let down friends. We broke up with somebody in a bad way. We cheated, we lied. What would it be like to just close things, forgiving yourself, meeting the pain, seeing it objectively, what was wrong, and let it be. Another little piece of poetry that I have on my notice board. So the sea journey goes on, and who knows where. Just to be held by the ocean is the best of luck we could have. It's a total waking up. Why should we grieve that we've been sleeping? It does not matter how long we've been unconscious. We're groggy, but let the guilt go. Feel the motion of tenderness around you, the buoyancy. What would it be like to meet ourselves with an ocean of tenderness, of acceptance? Just to be at peace with the being we are. And then it goes further when we can start to give ourselves some real room in life, when we can take our place on the earth. We really take our seat. We inhabit our body, meet ourselves with more kindness. We can feel the deeper longing in the heart. We can feel the deeper grief in the heart, the existential grief, the yearning. Now, we have so many desires, so many wants, but underneath them all, the deepest wanting is to be one, the oneness, the ending of separation, the peace that is possible, to end the separation in the heart. So we can turn to this sense of separation, this ache, this irritant sense of loss that causes all these feelings of nameless dissatisfaction. It's not quite right. A hunger for something, but what? And no matter how many chocolate cakes or cappuccinos or special experiences one may have, it's not it. Not even the best of relationships. You know, the heart wants this. The heart wants us to turn to the deepest ache and be present there. We don't need to do so much, but be willing to feel that to. So kindness and compassion in the Buddhist tradition, they're called the divine abidings. It's like the home of the heart, the home of our being. It's what's original to our nature, kindness and compassion. When we relax, when we really relax and stop, that's what's there. And then there's two more, the four abidings. Third one is joy. Joy is different from pleasure. You know, pleasure is always opposed to pain. But joy can be there even with difficulty, even with pain. So women that have given birth sometimes experience this intense pain beyond description, but also joy. It goes completely well together. Sometimes we can be with deep grief, and if we're wholehearted with the grief, it can feel satisfying in a way that may be joyful. It has to do with an openness to the moment, to your experience, being yourself, not striving. And it's a joy that's uncaused. Mostly when we think of joy, it's out in the object, right? It's out there for us to get. And perhaps we're not getting enough of it, or not the right thing, or it will not be there for me. But joy is in the heart. It's a response in the heart. It's a phenomena in the heart. It's a capacity in the heart that arises in contact. The mind thinks joy is only possible with this, with this, with this, with this. It's true, joy manifests when there is fulfillment. And that's why in loving kindness practice, there is a kind of practice of wishing, wishing for goodness. And sometimes we can feel the joy of that, to just wish for the goodness for ourselves, for other beings. And we can delight in things going well, when things go well for us and for others. Could you feel that sometimes in the small group meetings, in listening to others, there can be a feeling of resonance, but also a feeling of joy in just hearing, like, oh, just hearing somebody speak truthfully. Or somebody seeing something clearly and feeling that kind of, oh, feeling glad for another. Rejoicing in the happiness and well-being of another. It's also joy is intimately connected with curiosity, that happiness in finding out, in discovering. And the kind of discovery that comes from not knowing, when we quiet down and we relax into the heart, so that we can truly discover anew, beyond the historic structures and the hardening of the heart, to really discover. There's a great joy in that. We can be really turned on by exploring and engaged. And that brings a confidence in that the discovery of awakening is possible, a confidence in one's journey, a confidence in practice. And it's a joy that's unearned. It's not because you're worth it, or because you've been good. It's a joy for its own sake. And when we quiet down and we have some curiosity, when kindness is there, we can start to uncover what the heart really needs, what supports the heart. And now all these popular images of the heart and what love is, fluffy, sweet, oh, I love you, and the heart should be full. It's true, the heart can be full and rich. But maybe what the heart needs most is something else. A little bit radical. Something like poverty. Something like complete simplicity. It's not like the heart needs more of anything. We get so preoccupied in all these stories. I need to be loved. I need to... It's true. We need a lot of things because we're human beings. It's true, we need contact, we need care. But the depth of the heart doesn't exactly need all those things. What does the heart need? The nature of the heart is to surrender, to let go. Not to grab hold on, but to let go. To let be. To forgive, to to accept? Can we allow the heart to let go? This is the capacity of the heart. You know, all our attachments and our desires and all the compulsion in that, all the wanting, it really disconnects us from our nature. The truth of the heart is really empty, more empty than we ever could imagine, more spacious, more silent, and yet kind. There is a piece of poetry by Thomas Tranströmer, and do you know what a vault is? It's in a cathedral or in a church or in some other kind of building when a ceiling is kind of rounded and immense. That's a vault. This one is called Romanesque Arches. Vault gaped behind vault, no complete view. A few candle flames flickered. An angel with no face embraced me and whispered throughout my whole body, "Do not be ashamed of being human. Be proud. Inside you, vault opens behind vault endlessly. You will never be complete. That's how it's meant to be." Blind with tears, I was pushed out on the sun-drenched piazza together with Mr. and Mrs. Jones, Mr. Tanaka and Signorina Sabatini. And inside them all, vault opened behind vault endlessly. The fourth of the true capacities of the heart is that of equanimity. You familiar with the word equanimity in English? Can somebody give a translation? It's a kind of dynamic neutral, to be in balance, even. No fit.
There are many ways to translate it in Finnish.
It may not be a capacity we associate with the heart to be balanced. So let me illustrate it a bit, perhaps. Is this capacity to be deeply in contact but not affected? Not be so emotionally affected, to be even, balanced. It's a kind of kind, contactful neutrality, steady. I have two examples. There was an Indian film star, a Bollywood star, and there was a film crew following him, filming him, and he was going into his brand new Porsche Cayenne, nice car, and this was quite some years ago. It was a very nice car, especially in Mumbai. And so he was driving, film crew was there, and went out on the street, and there were the rickshaw drivers, and thought, oh, what a car! And then there were accidents and colliding and driving off the road, and there was stuff happening, and the film crew started to film all this commotion, and said to Mr. Filmstar, did you see what happened? And he said, if it offends anyone, but he said with the wonderful Hindi accent, he said, oh, it happens all the time only. That's not equanimity. But the Dalai Lama, on the other hand, he was interviewed once by a Western journalist who had heard about one of his students, an elderly monk who had come from far away to meet with the Dalai Lama and to be instructed in certain practices. And the Dalai Lama, in his kindness, said to this elderly monk, you know, these practices are demanding. I think they will be too much for you. You don't need to do them. The monk took it in the wrong way, and the story says he killed himself, he committed suicide. The journalist, the interviewer, had heard of this story, asked the Dalai Lama, how did you get over it? And the Dalai Lama was silent for quite some time. And then he said, very calmly, I didn't. And he kind of looked perplexed, like, why should I get over it? This is the capacity of the heart. We do not need to get over our history and our stuff. We do not need to. It can be met with kindness, with a depth of willingness to experience, and equanimity, that evenness that can say, I didn't. I did not get over it. Can you sense the space in that? The spaciousness in that. So we can make our heart mind a good place to live because it is of goodness. You know, we come from the Christian tradition, Judeo-Christian tradition, that has this fascinating concept of original sin. So no matter how much I've studied myself and explored, I haven't found this original sin. I can't find it. I really cannot find it. What I find is goodness, the absolute goodness of the heart. Yes, terrible things happen. People do terrible things out of fear, out of anger, out of desperation. This is all true. And from one generation to the next, the pain is carried on. From parents to children, from nations. This is all true. It's an ocean of pain, an ocean of fighting and aggression. But the truth of the heart is good. To know this matters. The heart is good, pure. These qualities are there when we turn to look, to sense. And even better, it can be practiced, cultivated. So in the Buddhist tradition, we incline the mind towards kindness. We practice metta. And when we do, our capacity for kindness grows, becomes more robust. We practice compassion by being willing to turn towards the difficult and feel it all the way down beyond historic pain to the original pain of existing, that which sets the heart free. We practice equanimity by being steady in the moment throughout the day, showing up for ourselves. And we practice joy by being full and enjoying recognizing the sweet and the wonderful and the pleasurable. May all beings be met by kindness. May all beings know love and well-being. May the true nature of the heart awaken. May we embody the truth of the heart.